I'm Mike O'Brien. I work for the City of Portland, for all of you, in the Office of Sustainable Development. That's the office that manages the city's solid waste and recycling programs, energy programs, the Global Warming Action Plan, and the Green Building Program. And that's what I work in. So that's kind of been my connection with Peak Oil, coming to the meetings to find out what people are thinking about and talking about on this topic. And in my life working on energy efficient and green buildings, I have frequently encountered our speaker tonight, Charlie Stevens. He's a senior policy analyst at the state of Oregon, the Oregon Department of Energy. That doesn't begin to tell you what he does, though. Almost everything that's happened in Oregon in the last, I don't know how many years.
Please.
Probably like about 20 years ago. Has had his hand on it. So if you take advantage of the business energy tax credit in Oregon, you're doing something to use solar energy or renewables, and the state is giving you some support for doing that. Charlie had a hand in it. We're starting to see zero net energy houses in Oregon. The first one was built up in the far north East Portland last year. Maybe some of you had a chance to visit it. It's called the Rose House, Elvin Haynes and Linda Rose's house. Charlie and his compatriot at Odo, Christopher Diamond, were instrumental in making that house happen and in supporting the technology that went into that house. So this is a person who knows a great deal about energy and has been working on behalf of Oregonians for a long time to make it all happen. So will you join me in welcoming here to Peak Oil tonight?
Thank you, Mike. Thank you. Mike always, he frequently gets a little bit flattering about things, so I'm glad he kept that somewhat short. As Mike might have indicated indirectly here, I get my knowledge for what I'm going to be talking about tonight from my job. I can also say that this is my hobby. International affairs, international energy affairs, international water and agricultural affairs. All that stuff is stuff that I read and study pretty hard on my own time. So a lot of what you're going to come upon here tonight is not just from what I get on the job, it's from what I get in a lot of places. Later on, when we start talking about what are we all going to do about this, we might get into some policy discussions. I can fairly well say that I can't really represent the agency's policy here very well, but I can certainly give you my own opinions, and I will. How much of that ultimately finds its way into state policy, I can't say right now, because an awful lot of this stuff is just beginning. There's a handful of us. I'm not the only one at the agency that has a pretty good grasp of this stuff. There's a good six or eight of us that follow this stuff very, very closely and have been for some years now. We are very much aware of it, though translating this into policy is a very difficult chore. It's, you know, government, especially elected officials, sort of are the last ones to go somewhere. They follow you folks. You know, if you show them where you want to go, they'll go there if it's politically expedient. So we're going to try to help them get there. So I'm going to talk tonight about a topic that I think most of you already know about, or you wouldn't be sitting here. Most of you are at least aware of the topic, and I am going to really breeze through a number of Peak Oil slides. I will stop periodically to talk about bits and pieces and individual ones. I will also stop for your questions if something's not clear. I don't really want to cut you off. We want to keep rolling here. But this issue, Peak Oil, is a lot like... let's try this and see if it works. Oh, let me turn that on first. Power. Uh-oh. Wrong thing. Oh. Yeah, that was the button. I thought I was turning the power to this on because it wasn't responding.
You know, I'm going to try to pick you up.
Okay.
I'm going to try to pick you up without the
mic. Without the mic?
Well, I can't hear what you're saying because these are buzzings.
I've got a separate mic on.
Yeah. Yeah, there's more
sounds
than...
worse?
No.
A separate sound source.
Did the power just go off?
I turned it off. The remote works, but it doesn't work to advance the slides, but it works to turn the power off.
maybe we need to reset his connection.
I don't know what...
Let's take a look.
He's all right. It's me.
Where's your mic?
It's right here. That's off. That's on.
That's it.
It's in this little canister here.
Here's the connection.
Oh, there.
All right, how's that? Still hear a buzz?
Yeah.
Still?
It could be my...
I'm sorry, Mike. I turned the darn thing off, and it's...
Did you turn the mic on?
Okay, you're right.
Okay. Now, let me see if... I haven't been able to advance it, so...
Okay.
Did you turn the mic on in your pocket?
The bulb's just warming up.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
The button's actually...
Okay. That, okay, that worked.
Oh, okay, cool. There we go.
Okay, that worked.
I'm going to turn you guys on. Wherever that is.
Turn it off?
Fine.
On.
There
okay.
It is.
No, it's off.
Nah, don't worry about it. Just leave it off.
Okay. Let's go. Everything seems to be working now. This peak oil issue is a lot like this sign. There's a lot of very big writing out there, and a few of you have picked it up. But the real message... Whoops. The real message is down there. And tonight I'm going to talk about the bridge being out here. And, I mean, that's really the point of this. Here's our energy and history. I think some of you will have seen these slides. That's why I'm going to whip through them. But in the grand scheme of things, from the year zero up to the year 2500, this is our fossil fuel age depicted here. This is what we're going through right now. This is the time period in human history, or the recent human history, quite frankly, over which we're blowing out our fossil fuel resources. The reason this is important is that each and every one of you who controls some fossil fuel, a gallon of gasoline has at your disposal that in combination with some machine like a car or an earth-moving piece of machinery or something of that nature, an airplane, whatever it is, you have at your disposal the equivalent of hundreds or thousands of slaves. You can accomplish with one Caterpillar D8 bulldozer what it took hundreds of people to accomplish in a month, and you can do this in a day. With a Caterpillar D9. And the reason you can do that is fossil fuel. So most of our society's recent history, the industrial age, shall we speak of, is founded on this notion that each human being now has at their disposal an enormous amount of power to work and transform the landscape and build things and excavate things and transform things. That's what's at the bottom of all of this. This is a schematic. Now, don't try to read this. But this is a schematic of the U.S. energy system and our energy use. These are all the inputs over here on the left. This big one here is coal, natural gas, nuclear up here, a little bit of hydro, biomass, petroleum and natural gas liquids. And then we got down here imports. If you add all that up and you follow this through, it comes out on the other end. And you can see over here that lost energy over here, the stuff that is a waste, is over 55% of what comes in on the left. So we're squandering more than half of what we actually bring into the system on the left. It is doing nothing useful for us, but it is damaging the planet. This is U.S. energy use by sector. I don't know how many people have seen this, but you can see transportation is a rather large chunk. It's more than a quarter. The interesting thing about transportation is it's mostly petroleum. It's mostly oil. And that's a real problem because there aren't as many substitutes for that we know of right now as there are for some of the other things. Industrial down there is about a third. Commercial buildings are about 15%. And residential energy use is up there pretty close to 20%, pretty close to a fifth. Yeah. That's a very difficult number to break out because you're going to have a very difficult time defining what military is. For instance, do you count the Veterans Administration and all of their hospitals?
No.
Ah, you should. It's military. If you take all that budget, what a lot of people don't realize is two-thirds of the discretionary budget is military if you get it in the right place. Nuclear. How much of the nuclear program is military? That's a very good question, but there's the military's actual fuel consumption is as the grand total of all of our fuel consumption is actually not that big. Their role in procuring all of the rest of that fuel is a big thing, but they don't use that much. Most of it's used by aviation in the military.
3% of domestic production.
Yeah, it's a very small number. The problem is aviation is an enormous fuel consumer. It's a very disproportionate fuel consumer. Ah, what's happening here? Let's try that. Okay, fuel energy density. This is another root of our problem. Remember I mentioned about petroleum being a really important element. You can sort of see that the densest energy, if you look down at the bottom there, is hydrogen in terms of gigajoules per ton. The trick about hydrogen is it's also the smallest molecule out there. And it's really tough to get a hold of a ton of that stuff and confine it and put it in some sort of a form that you can use. A lot of people talk about hydrogen being sort of a figment as a solution to some of our problems because it's not an energy source, it's an energy carrier. Those people should remember that oil and gasoline are not an energy source either. They are an energy carrier as well. All of this stuff derived from the sun, ultimately. All of the energy on this planet derived from or derives from our solar income. This planet is a closed system with the exception of our solar income. When it was created and when you use it can be transformed. But ultimately, it is a closed system. It all came from the sun, ultimately. So all of this stuff is an energy carrier. U.S. oil mix. You can sort of see the thing you need to take from this slide right here, there's no scales or anything on there, is the slopes of the lines, okay? Texas, on the downhill. The rest of the USA, going down. Natural gas liquids, on the way down. Alaska, on the way down. Imports, on the way up, okay? Total use, on the way up. Note the slopes of those lines. Look at the proportions. That's all we're trying to get across with this slide. Okay. This is one of a number of slides that sort of show you that there's a bit of a delay between the oil we discover, these sort of light gray areas on the left, and how we use it. Okay, we've discovered about 90% of the oil there is to discover. Most of it was discovered 30 to 40 years ago. Okay, and that's what we're using right now. Discoveries in the 1990s tapered off to almost nothing. Typically what happens is you discover it, you catalog it, you characterize it. When I say characterize it, you figure out what refining processes are going to be needed to use it. All oil is not the same. The tar sands in Alberta are not the same as light sweet crude out of Saudi Arabia. The latter is the really preferred oil. It takes very little energy in to get that energy out. You go to tar sands in Canada, it takes an enormous amount of energy in to get, it takes one energy unit in to get three out. In Saudi Arabia, when they first started pumping oil in Saudi Arabia, it was one energy unit in, 100 units out. We're down to about one in and 10 out worldwide right now for most of the oil, and that also is on the decline. When people talk to you about the economics of oil, it's not just the dollar economics, it's the energy economics. It's the net energy that you can get out of the activities, you might say, that bring you the energy. Once you get down to 1-to-1, where it's taking one energy unit in to get one out at the gas pump, what's the point? I don't care how much oil is left in the ground, and I don't care how much technology you have. If it takes one energy unit in to get one out at the pump, you're not going to do that. Even if there's 40% of the oil still sitting there in the ground. We're not going to go after it on an energy basis alone. Drilling more doesn't help. We're drilling like crazy. I can tell you that there's not a rig available right now in almost any part of the world that isn't drilling. They're building rigs. They're going crazy drilling. But it's not really turning up all that much oil. You can sort of see on the left, going back to 1960, things were looking pretty good there in the green. That's the net, you know, production here. Now we're in the deficit. We're now in the stage where we are using more every month than we are producing, drilling and producing. Not good. U.S. production. I'm going to give you a little history here and try to tie some things together so you all understand what happened. It's not entirely as it was shown in the history books in a way. In 1960, the U.S. produced roughly half of the world's oil. Texas produced about three-quarters of that, almost three-quarters of that. Texas was the predominant oil producer on the planet in 1960. Now, in 1955, M. King Hubbard had projected that U.S. oil production would decline somewhere around 1970. Everybody laughed at him and told him he was nuts. By 1970, things were booming. Maximum year of U.S. production. Everybody looked again at M. King Hubbard and said, boy, that guy was really nuts. Here it is, 1970, and look at us. Most oil we've ever produced. Literally. By 1971, it had gone over the top. And when they looked back in 1972, what happened was the Texas Railroad Commission, which governed Texas oil production, they, up until 1971, controlled the price of oil. They controlled it by controlling the output of Texas. If prices got a little high, they'd boost production in Texas and bring it back down again. Prices got a little low, they'd pull back a little production, get the prices back up there again. Well, in 1971, they found out they'd lost control. Prices were going up. The Texas Railroad Commission said, more oil, pump. And they said, sorry, we're already pumping all we can. Well, that became obvious at that moment that Texas had lost control of prices in the world. It didn't become obvious to the rest of the world until late in 1972. It became obvious to the countries that had become OPEC about that time. When the 1973 war occurred between Israel and Egypt, and of course that drew in all the rest of the players around Israel, the Arabs were pretty angry. They controlled OPEC at the time, and they said, we're going to show these people. They knew by that time that they had control of the price of oil. They were now the marginal barrel of oil. Texas wasn't. That's how come they were able to do what they did in 1973, which was just withhold oil from the market. The price quadrupled overnight. It was, the price in 1973 before April was $1.80 a barrel. Okay, that's what it was going for. It became $11 a barrel by June. And that's what killed the economy. So, I mean, those are in 1973 dollars, mind you. But the fact is, that's the kind of dollars we were talking about back then. That's what caused the first oil crisis in this country. By 1975, the administration had worked out a deal with the Saudis. We'll protect you and your regime and the royal family and the control you have over your country if you manage the price of oil. There was a deal struck in 1975, and the Saudis have been able to follow through on that ever since. In 1979, there was a crisis with Iran. When the Shah fell, it temporarily removed from production some oil, and the prices spiked again. You can actually see those things in the graph here. It's hard to see, but that's what these kind of dips are in some of the graphs that you'll see here, is you'll see these things show up. Okay, two-thirds of our resource base are in those giant fields. Ghawar in Saudi Arabia is the largest of these. That produces right now 4.4 million barrels a day. It's the largest producing field on the planet, single producing field. Saudi Arabia only has 12 fields that are producing, and they're being produced out of 31 rigs. That's it. But they're producing 9 million barrels a day, plus or minus. Nobody knows exactly what the number is, but that's about what it is. Now, there's a whole bunch of countries that are post-peak, and they're on their way down. Australia, Norway is kind of right at the top and ready to go into peak. Great Britain, Canada, for conventional oil has peaked, but their tar sands are what's keeping them up right now. Malaysia, Syria, India, Egypt, Indonesia, all these countries have been oil producers, but they are now in decline. So what we've got is a whole bunch of countries whose oil is declining. Now, there's this concern some of you have read about OPEC reserves. Here's the numbers that you can sort of see. This year right here is 1988. You can sort of see that Iraq got the jump on it back up in here in 1983. And 1985, Kuwait jumped in. Everybody jumped in when the deal was struck by OPEC members that production would be based on reserves, proven reserves. Well, all of a sudden, everybody's proven reserves jumped. Abu Dhabi, 31 to 92. Dubai, 1.4 to 4. Iran, 48.8 to 92.9. Iraq, 47 to 100. Kuwait, 64 to 90. Saudi Arabia, 170 billion barrels to 257 billion barrels. Just with the snap of a finger. Do you believe it? Matthew Simmons doesn't believe it. Okay, here's some oil company views that we've run into in print. Okay, gas production has peaked in North America. 2001, that was the peak year. That's why you hear so much talk about liquefied natural gas. The era of easy oil is over. What they mean by that is dollars and energy. You know, remember I talked about energy in versus energy out. That's what Chevron's talking about here. I also listened not too long ago at the World Affairs Council of Portland. They had the president and CEO of Occidental Petroleum speaking. And I sat there listening as he said, look, for people who think technology's coming to our rescue, not going to happen. The fact is, we're using every bit of technology we know how to use today, and what you see is what you're getting. And he didn't know of any technologies that were just around the corner that were going to help us out in any significant way. They're always improving things in a marginal sort of way, but for significant things, not going to happen. Now, this is the most critical graph to lead into the part of the discussion that we're going to go into next. This is sort of the basic curve that you all know about that represents peak production in barrels per day. We don't know exactly what that number is. We think it's in the mid to high 80s, million barrel per day. The problem is that you're hearing everybody arguing over is peak oil in 2005, 2006, 2009, and everybody's arguing and arguing. The problem is that's peak over here. Where we think we are right now is back here. This is where the demand and the supply curve separate. When that happens and you start going over the top while your demand is still going like this, that's when the economic damage begins. That's what peak oil's first impact is major economic damage. That's why prices are spiked up to where they are. Now, mind you, through June of this year, 85% of the price increases that you saw had nothing to do with this phenomenon. They had to do with the devaluation of the dollar. Okay? If you go back to, if you're paying for oil in euros today, your prices are only about 17 or 18% higher than they were in 2003. But if you're paying dollars, you're getting the shaft here. Your prices are more than double what they were in 2003. So it's the devaluation of the dollar that was driving oil prices through June. Only since June have we begun to see this problem here between supply and demand starting to manifest itself in higher prices. So anything up to $50 to $55 a barrel is just devaluation of the dollar. Now that you're up into the $60 per barrel, now we begin the real fun when this thing gets out of hand.
Sorry?
Yeah.
Question?
Mm-hmm.
I know that like a month or two ago we saw the highest gas prices, but they seem to have come down, even like 20 cents, 30 cents.
There's a lag. There's always a lag, and you have to remember this is the interaction between refining and oil supply. What happens, what you're seeing today in the prices coming down is, remember there was an announcement made about, a month and a half, 2 months ago, that President Bush was releasing a bunch of oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. He sells that stuff out of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve at $20 a barrel. Okay? So, now mind you, that does not comprise a huge fraction of what's going through the refineries. But it's enough at $20 a barrel to make a somewhat of a dent in the price that can come out the other end. Okay?
How much is left in that reserve, do you know?
I don't know exactly. I think it's about 700 million barrels.
And aren't prices still higher in other parts of the country, like the South, for instance?
Yes, that's a constraint on delivery. There's some pipelines that experience problems. Remember, I'm going to give you rough numbers here. About a quarter of our oil production and our refining, actually closer to 30% of our refining, but a quarter of the production of oil comes through Louisiana, okay, including Texas's stuff, some of Texas's oil. An even bigger fraction of our natural gas comes through there. So temporarily, we've got refining issues, and refining issues are what's driving product prices at the pump in the parts of the country that those refineries feed. Here in the Northwest, we're isolated. Our refining is done up in the Seattle, Puget Sound area, Anacortes, actually. There's four refineries up there that pretty much do all of our refining. Most of our oil comes out of Alaska to feed our system here. A lot of it gets here. A lot of the gasoline gets here by pipeline from up there. Basically, you have to look at exchange rates that are... What you do is you look at the quoted prices for oil in the various currencies. And you can figure out that, you know, if you're paying... In 2003, if you're paying 21 euros for a barrel of oil and $29, there's a fixed ratio there valued by a barrel of oil. Later, you see $23.80 or 23.8 euros per barrel, and you see $41 per barrel, you can start to see that there's a disparity going on. You cross-check over to the euro versus the dollar, and there it is. You have to start looking at the various indicators of the system health all the way back to the fields, but looking at tanker, you know, how many rigs are drilling versus how many rigs are idle, how many tankers are contracted for and how many are still available, you know, who's got how much oil on the market based on production numbers that we can actually know. Pretty soon you start taking these things where you're saying people are putting out for more production and they're not getting it. Saudi Arabia, for instance, here's one indicator. Saudi Arabia said, good, we'll put another 50,000 barrels a day online immediately, and we'll put another 150,000 online within 3 weeks. They did. No one bought it. The reason no one bought it is because it was heavy crude, sour crude. It couldn't be refined using the refining capacity that was available. It was set up to refine light, sweet crude. No good with sour stuff with a lot of sulfur in it that's really heavy. So the problem isn't always just supply, but that's all anybody could produce. That was the only oil that was put on the market, and it wasn't even bought because there was no refining capacity for it. No one else stepped forward to throw some more production online.